Chapter 12. Icy Waves and Demon Fire. Though the twilight air was not especially warm, the cold water splashing high and washing back across the deck felt good on Wolfgar's bare arms and face. He found it invigorating and bracing, putting him in the exact frame of mind he would need to fulfill his duties this day. The droplets flew up above him, catching the last rays of sunlight glinting across the water before them from the right, the western horizon, which now seemed to be swallowing the sun. He was on a swift ship, Joan's heirloom, in full sail with following seas out of Luskin Harbor, slashing through the swells to meet an incoming flotilla of invaders, mostly human, but with other, more notorious creatures, including one ship, so the scout ships had reported, crewed entirely by vicious gnolls. The hope was to parley, with Luskin showing a powerful force of its own, nearly 100 vessels representing all 5 of the city's high captains, and including quieter but more powerful reinforcements still, like the Drow man standing not far from Wolfgar on this very deck. "We'll not strike any sails," he heard Calico Grimm, the ship's captain, tell that unusual Drow, and in a tone too sharp, Wolfgar thought.
"He's busy," Wolfgar called back over his shoulder. "Busy?"
The captain's confusion didn't surprise Wolfgar. Camoriel was simply standing there, propped and secured against the rail of the higher prow deck. To all appearances, he was just standing and watching, but Wolfgar knew better. Camoriel's consciousness wasn't in his body at that time, but was far away reporting to Jarlaxle. He had bidden Wolfgar to watch over him, over his helpless physical form at least, while his spirit was far afield. When Wolfgar didn't respond, the captain snorted, and Wolfgar turned again to make sure that the foolish Grimm didn't strike the strange Drow. They certainly didn't need that out here on the open waters. Calico Grimm was a rough one, aye, but he'd do better than picking any fights with this particular dark elf. Even not counting Camuriel's position of power within the Bregan d'Erth, whose complete domination of Luskin was an open secret among all the crews, this Drow was not one to be trifled with. Wolfgar would rather anger Jarlaxle, or even the great Gromph Banry himself, before engaging in any conflict with Camoriel and his strange and unsettling psionics. Wolfgar could understand a fireball, and while ducking under one wouldn't be a pleasant experience, against Camoriel such an explosion would happen inside one's mind, an illusion become all too real, and with no place to hide and no cover to shield. It was cold on the water, but for the first time today he shuddered. "Have I asked you to do so?" came an unemotional response from Camoriel, an apparent reply to Calico Grimm's first declaration. Wolfgar swiveled his head to regard the Drow. Was there any other kind of response from this one? With a helpless shake of his head, confident now that Camoriel was back in control of his physical body and therefore of the situation around him, Wolfgar looked back out over the prow, squinting against the spray, pondering, and not for the first time, whether Camoriel was actually alive or just an animated construct, or even some emotionless, undead thing.
"You're demanding parley," Calico Grimm said.
"I am saying that it is wiser. We do not know the disposition of this fleet or what intent brings them so far to the north."
"You know what happened in the crags in Port Last," Calico Grimm reminded.
"I do."
"They've gnolls sailing with them,"
added Bonnie Charlie, the first mate, a woman covered in battle scars, the grease of rope lines and sea spray.
"I admit, it does not look like a happy enjoining," said Camoriel.
"Eh?"
asked the captain.
"Says they're going to be shooting at us," Bonnie Charlie remarked.
"I will discern their intent before we ever get close enough for any meaningful exchange of words or missiles," Camoriel assured the pair.
"And how do you propose to—" the captain started to ask. "Just believe him,"
Wolfgar interjected. He swung around a guide rope to turn back facing the trio.
"Believe him," he repeated. We'll know all about this approaching fleet long before they learn anything much about us.
Calico Grim and Bonnie Charlie exchanged looks and a shrug.
If they're wanting to talk, then we'll do it one boat out to one boat, Calico Grim told Camoriel. And no other is striking sails or unloading catapults. If it comes to a fight and they lose, they run. If we lose our home behind us. Don't you forget that when you're asking for a parley, eh?
Eh, indeed, Camoriel snorted dismissively. Wulfgar glanced back to the approaching fleet, then turned back to see Camoriel walking toward him, the captain and his first mate staring angrily at the psionicist's back, and both looking like they were about to say something unpleasant. Wulfgar slowly shook his head at them, and to his surprise, the two remained quiet. The four watched the approaching sails draw nearer. Then Camoriel announced, I go.
You go where? Calico Grim asked.
The drow closed his eyes and seemed to shrink within himself.
To parley, Wulfgar answered for him. Hey now, what do you mean by that? Patience, Captain, Wulfgar said. When the drow speaks again, we will know much more about those who sail against us.
Brevendon Margaster paced the deck of the square-masted caravel, wondering how it had come to this, and wondering, too, if he could end the path he was on simply by removing the magical necklace, a phylactery that contained the spirit of a most wicked Cambion. It seemed so simple, after all. Remove the necklace and toss it into the sea. He could do it, then go to his sister, Inkeri, and take her necklace and those of the other Margaster nobles, and similarly be rid of the demons. So simple. But his hands did not move, and his doubts crept higher. What would happen to him, to them all, when the lords of Waterdeep learned the truth of the Margaster family? How might anyone protect them when all the powers of the North came to realize that the Margasters had been washing money with Lord Neverember, stealing millions from the city? Brevendon had thought the whole thing funny at first. Wasn't the back-dealing and double-crossing all just a game, after all? Everyone was corrupt, of course, so what harm could it be? Also, Lord Dagold Neverember, who had hatched the schemes with Inkeri, was one of the most respected and powerful men on the Sword Coast. Like many Waterdavian men his age, Brevendon had grown up idolizing the handsome Dagold. Every woman wanted him, every warrior wanted to train with him. What did it matter, then? If the Margasters threw in with Neverember in creating a new power about Neverwinter City, perhaps to rival Waterdeep itself in the coming years, why would that be any worse than the current lords ruling, essentially, the entire Sword Coast north of Baldur's Gate, with the sole exception of Luskin, which was in control of pirates, or worse if the rumors were true? The justifications rang hollow to him, and Brevendon blew a heavy sigh, wondering how it had come to this point. How was it that he was leading a fleet of scoundrels and scallywags, unrepentant murderers, one and all, and with a boatload of gnolls along for the ride? How had it come to pass that the army thrown against King Brunner would be led by demons, actual demons, pulled from the abyss to rain carnage on the enemies of Neverember? Brevendon couldn't even remember who had given the order, or when it had been decided that they would march against Gauntlegrim. One little step had led to another, to another, to another, and seemingly, suddenly, here they were. The fleet had just left the unfortunate settlement of Port Last, which was mostly in ruins now, the surviving citizens put to work in their quarries in service to the House of Margaster.
You cannot do great things if you fear small inconveniences, said a voice in Brevendon's head.
The voice of Asbeel, the Cambion contained within the phylactery hanging about the Margaster nobleman's neck. No, not contained, he thought. Perhaps initially it had been so, but that word wouldn't properly describe the phylactery or the relationship between Asbeel and Brevendon anymore. Asbeel was in Brevendon's thoughts at Asbeel's preference, not Brevendon's. In the phylactery, Asbeel could hide from him, but the enchanted bauble was no longer a two-way barrier. Was there anywhere Brevenant could now hide from Asbeel?
No,
the voice in his head answered the thought. Brevenant gave a helpless laugh.
When Luskin is ours, you will begin to see the gain and glory of it all, impatient host,
Asbeel telepathically imparted. Brevenant tried to mentally agree or pretend to agree, or something, anything, to keep the beast from looking deeper into his thoughts. And of course he knew that Asbeel had felt that effort as well. Before the demon could respond, however, a shout rang across the ship. "Sails to the north!" came the cry from the crow's nest high above. Brevenant was glad for the distraction, any distraction. "Many sails!" the man above yelled. "The Luskin fleet, to be sure!" Brevenant smiled, reminding himself that Luskin was under the control of the Dark Elves, friends of Brunner and so enemies of Lord Neverember. This was a fight, he told himself resolutely, against enemies worthy of feeling the sharp edge of his weapon. But then he winced yet again. Considering the new black blade slung across his back, a curving, viciously serrated bastard sword, with a handle of jagged spikes that cut into his hands when he wielded it, biting barbs digging deep into his flesh. The torturous sword healed him as fast as it wounded him, leaving him with no injury but in constant torment. A reminder to be done with his enemies quickly, as Beel had told him. Brevenant had not yet wielded the finished sword in battle. Its enchantments and magical edge had only been completed in the town of Port Last after the sacking. But he could well imagine its horrible power. Merely thinking of an enemy while holding the sword in hand brought a coating of biting red fire to the metal. And though the sword was not telepathic in any meaningful sense, Brevenant could certainly feel its hunger. It had been designed for one purpose alone, to inflict horrible pain. Fashioned with a purpose, the weapon ever sought to satisfy that hunger.
"Your imagination is not strong enough to truly understand the pleasure,"
as Beale's telepathic voice rang in his head, melodic and high-pitched, the voice of an elf but twisted and grating. Brevenant tried hard to focus on the task before him, on reminding himself that Luskin was under drow control, and so this was not an unwarranted attack, and to turn his thoughts from the sword. Asbeel's sword. The awful, terrible, diabolical sword.
Like a ghost, Kimuriel's disembodied thoughts soared across the cold water, closing fast on the incoming enemy fleet. With a quick perusal, he became confident as to which was likely the command ship, so much larger and finer was it than the others. He gave it a wide berth, circling up high. One man, dressed in expensive armor and with a large black sword strapped to his back, was clearly giving the commands here. Kimuriel went past him to the wheel before the aft deck to a chubby and greasy little human who looked quite simple-minded. All the better. A moment later, the psionicist blinked through human eyes and was surprised at how dark the evening had become, absent his keen drow vision. It didn't much matter, for the pilot stood within earshot now of the ship's captain. Kimuriel soon enough confirmed from the imprisoned mind of the man he had possessed that the captain was indeed the fleet commander. That man, well-dressed Lord Brevenant by name, he knew from his hostage, snapped his head about suddenly to regard Kimuriel, or at least to regard the man Kimuriel had possessed. Surely Brevenant couldn't know. The captain waved away a nearby woman moving to ask him something, then painted on a wicked grin, drew the terrible sword over his shoulder, and took a step toward Kimuriel. Kimuriel looked into his thoughts. The drow psionicist floated out of the possessed pilot just before Lord Brevenant, his jaw clenched in apparent pain, cut the man nearly in half, that wicked sword driving through the poor fool's shoulder, down across his chest, and out just above the opposite hip. Knowing now the truth of the commander and his minions, including a sorceress who appeared human but certainly was not, Kimuriel didn't look back but soared across the waters and into his own corporeal body with all speed.
"Well?"
Calico Grimm demanded of him the moment he blinked his eyes and moved. There is no parley,
Kimuriel replied. So we fight, the captain said, turning to Bonnie Charlie and nodding. The woman leaped away to order full sails.
Or run, Kimuriel quietly replied.
Eh? Calico Grim said. What? You ain't got the spine for a good fight, skinny one?
Wolfgar shook his head, unsurprised by the sardonic drow's typically cynical expression.
Kimuriel's snort in response was all that he needed to reply. The captain took it as if the drow was simply answering a challenge against his courage, of course. But Kimuriel glanced at Wolfgar and knew that the veteran warrior understood the true context of the dismissive response. Kimuriel really didn't care if they fought the incoming fleet or not. Kimuriel had spent years living among the Illithids. He wasn't much concerned about getting killed in such a crude battle, after all. The crews of all the boats around him were singing, off-key in different songs and different words even to those songs they were trying to coordinate. But their energy was infectious and exhilarating, and with the spray in his face and battle against a worthy foe so near, Wolfgar could not wipe the smile from his face. He was a warrior to his bones in this life and in his previous. He lived and thrived on the edge of fear because nowhere else could he feel himself so very much alive. Almost nowhere else, he corrected himself in his thoughts. And he imagined then that he was in the arms of Penelope. He wished she was here and was glad she was not all at the same time, and so he told himself, vowed to himself, that he would survive this fight and return to her. The first skirmish began far to the side of Joanne's heirloom, where a stroke of lightning and the flash of a fireball erupted, two ships closing to melee range and each leading with a blast from a wizard.
Do you wish to die out here, friend of Drizzt? Kimuriel asked him, and he spun on the strange drow as surprised by Kimuriel actually beginning a conversation with him as he was by the ridiculous question.
You know many who wish for death? Wolfgar replied.
He saw immediately that his sarcasm was lost on the drow.
No, of course I do not,
he answered more seriously.
It would not be an honorable death for you.
Yes, of course, a confused Wolfgar answered.
Kimuriel nodded, then pointed past the large man to a fine ship, the largest and most decorated vessel in sight.
They're commanders, I believe, he said. We should go.
Fireball, wizard, came cries from behind. Drow, where are you? They heard Calico Grim shouting.
Keep the course to that ship and perhaps we'll find victory, Kimuriel told Wolfgar,
and the drow turned and walked back amidships where Grim and Bonnie Charlie and others were scrambling, trying to find some cover. Following their looks, Wolfgar understood their fears, for on a ship closing from starboard stood a man in fanciful robes, waggling his fingers dramatically, wisps of flame wafting from them. Back amidships, the captain continued screaming at Kimuriel, a loud reminder that the drow was brought along on the word of High Commander Kurth, specifically that Kimuriel could provide the needed magical defense of the ship. When Kimuriel didn't respond, the volatile Grim began hurling insults against Kurth for foisting the drow upon him. Taking it all in, Wolfgar relaxed, seeing Kimuriel's posture. He had been thinking of going low over the side to the slack anchor line, down near the water and thick in the prow spray as protection from the incoming fireball. But now he decided against that course and simply stood his ground instead, because he knew what Kimuriel was capable of. Calico Grim ranted and yelled, even shoved the drow, who fell over limply to the deck, which only made the captain grow more incensed, to the point where he drew out his saber.
Do not, Wolfgar yelled. At the same time, another crewman called out for everyone to take cover. Indeed, across the way, the wizard went into the last moments of his spell casting, his hands aflame, creating another fiery bomb. He moved to throw it across the water to ignite Joanne's heirloom, but then he suddenly froze in place and simply held the pose. He was still holding his fireball when it exploded, engulfing his own ship in biting flames. Wolfgar laughed. Kimoriel stood back up and straightened his clothing. "Well now," Calico Grimm said, as much of an apology as the man would ever give.
"You should have some faith," Kimoriel told him, to which the captain snorted. "And you should repent your actions."
"What are ye meaning by that?" asked Bunny Charlie.
Kimoriel stared hard at Calico Grimm.
"Well?"
the first mate demanded. "Repent," Kimoriel ordered. Calico Grimm snorted, but then his face contorted weirdly, a look of utter surprise, a combination of shock and terror, the look of a man who was not alone in his own mind and body.
Calico Grimm spun about and sprinted away, past his surprised companion, running face first into Joanne's heirloom's mainmast. He dropped to the deck hard, blood flying from his nose, a pair of teeth falling out onto the boards.
Bunny Charlie gasped, then looked past the groaning captain to the laughing Wolfgar, who merely shrugged in response.
Clearly agitated, outraged even, the woman put her hands to the hilts of the daggers on her belt, and she turned to follow Kimoriel as he moved back toward Wolfgar.
The big man shook his head. Bonnie Charlie wisely did not draw.
It would have been the last thing she ever did, Wolfgar knew, unless one counted her gasping for her final breaths as she sank under the waves after, for some reason she could not understand, she had decided to jump into the middle of the ocean. Wolfgar found himself pleased that Bonnie Charlie hadn't so foolishly tossed her life away. And he found himself hoping that Calico Grimm, when he recovered from his faceplant, would. By the time Kimoriel arrived at the prow beside Wolfgar, it was clear that the lead enemy ship had noted their approach and was turning to meet the charge.
"His sword is a demon blade," Kimoriel warned. "Do not be struck."
"Whose?"
"Their commander. A Margaster, but much more than that."
Wolfgar nodded and brought his warhammer, Aegis Fang, into his hand, slapping the heavy weapon easily against his other palm.
"Mage ahead," came a cry.
"Let them blow themselves up then," said Wolfgar.
But Kimoriel shook his head.
"Such a possession as I performed before might overwhelm a stupid human, but not the spellcaster on the ship before us."
"You already know about him? Her?"
Wolfgar asked, changing the pronoun when he noted the woman at the prow of the ship, deep in concentration.
But then she wasn't, and she staggered back a step, blinking in confusion.
"I have bought you moments, Captain Grimm," Kimoriel called back. "If you slow, the wizard will strike at you."
Grimm spat out blood, but yelled to his pilot, "Bring her alongside, thump her hard and tangle the sails, and let's be done with these dogs."
"Brace!" came the shout all along Joanne's heirloom's deck, and the crew knew to a man and woman exactly what was expected of them. The swift schooner had been built for ramming and tangling. She was reinforced in all the critical areas, and the crew had been selected for their skill in close combat, as the pilot had been chosen for his talent and his nerve. He showed both then, guiding Joanne's heirloom in at full sail right alongside the enemy ship, close enough so that the tips of their longest spars crossed, tangling rigging. At that precise moment, the crew dropped the sails, and the pilot cut hard to starboard, crunching the ships together, tearing rigging and sails and locking them in place, the momentum of both pulling them in a dancer's turn and sending a swirl of watery swell outward. Both crews were quick to their respective rails, crossbows leveling and firing. A hulking ogre charged across the enemy's deck, leaping over the rail, flying for Joanne's heirloom. A spinning warhammer met the brute in midair, smashing it with tremendous force, enough to stop its breathing and its momentum. It flew in short, slamming against the side of Joanne's heirloom, somehow managing to catch the rail with one outstretched hand. But Wolfgar was there above it. The ogre groaned and tried to pull itself up.
"Tempus," Wolfgar whispered, the command word to return that warhammer to his grasp.
He let the ogre climb up just high enough, then drove the warhammer through its skull. The weapon tangled in the bone, so he let it drop into the sea with the dead behemoth.
"Ha!" he heard across the way and looked up just in time to see an enemy leveling his crossbow.
Wolfgar stared him down and moved with the speed of a viper when the quarrel flew his way. He wasn't quite quick enough for a full dodge and took it in the side, a painful bite and somewhat serious wound. But Wolfgar was in his battle lust now, and the pain angered him more than it hindered him. "Ha!" the archer across the way said again. "Tempus," Wolfgar replied, followed by a ha and throw of his own. The archer ducked, but Wolfgar had aimed low, expecting the dodge. The man got behind his ship's rail, which hardly mattered against the brute force of Aegis Fang, which broke through, slammed him, and sent him sprawling. More than a dozen feet separated the hulls, and many planks were being set by both sides, but Wolfgar didn't need that. A single running stride and leap sent him flying, calling to his god as he went to once again magically retrieve his warhammer. The poor wounded archer shrieked and clawed to get away. Wolfgar paid him no heed, for he hadn't the luxury. As soon as he skidded down on the deck, a handful of enemies charged at him. He set Aegis Fang in a wild spin, halting the charge, driving them back. On one swing, he let the hammer fly, striking dead one woman, throwing her broken body across the deck. Even as he let go, the barbarian half turned the other way, then leaned back to avoid the stab of a long pike. He caught the weapon shaft cleanly and, with a sudden and brutal jerk, launched the wielder into the air over the rail. Up went Wolfgar's left arm, bent at the elbow to catch the downward cut of a battle axe, the handle slamming his forearm, which didn't budge. He slapped that arm down and around, rolling his shoulders to slug the man with a right cross and with such force as to send that one too tumbling away. He knew that the remaining rogues were rushing in at his exposed back, but a roar brought Aegis Fang back into his hand, and this time, when he turned and swept the weapon powerfully about, he caught both in its sweep and sent them tumbling. By then, the planks were set and fighters charged back and forth, deck to deck, the melee growing wild all about him. Now the enemies couldn't come at Wolfgar altogether in coordinated fashion, so he waded along, easily destroying any who moved to intercept. For no shield short of Brunner's magnificent spiderweb buckler could hope to stop the pounding hammer, and no parry from a less than exceptional warrior could deflect the strong man's aim. It didn't take the fighters on the other ship long to realize that, and so the path became clear for Wolfgar. And not just for him, he noted, for his own crewmates were taking great pains to avoid a different warrior, one dressed in the magnificent armor of a water-deep nobleman and wielding a bastard sword with a curving black blade licked with fire. He knew in a moment who this was, and though it was unlikely that the man knew him by name, there was little doubt that this man, Brevenden Margaster, had seen the devastation Wolfgar had inflicted on his crew. The two stalked toward each other, each occasionally flicking out his weapon left or right to stop or even kill a lesser fighter. Slowly they closed, though, until they were but a few strides away, when both, as if some silent understanding had passed between them, leaped into the air and roared, coming together in a sudden whirlwind of fury. Kimoriel had warned Wolfgar that this one was more than he seemed, and Wolfgar was glad he had heeded the message, for in those first moments of combat, the barbarian came to realize that this foe was far more akin to Drizzt or Entreri than to what he'd expect from a pampered Water Davian lord. The man's sword worked in a blur, every movement sending it at Wolfgar in a different angle, sometimes a slash, sometimes a stab, sometimes a punch from the hilt. The big man soon found himself blocking more than attacking, the barrage coming at him relentlessly, and his opponent crying out as if in pain incessantly. Wolfgar realized the source soon enough as blood flew from the man's hand, from both hands when he gripped that awful spiked hilt with his second hand as well. The sword was wounding him and in turn inciting his rage, a fury that he threw into every strike. Had Kimoriel not warned him, Wolfgar expected that he would have been cut a dozen times already. Now he had the measure, and he fell into a rhythm of blocks, spinning his warhammer before him, sending it out with one hand, then both, deflecting a cut from the left, using it to keep the sword to his right by lifting it vertically before him and dodging left behind it, then clasping it wide-gripped horizontally, up high to intercept a powerful downward chop. And there was his opening, With remarkable agility for a man so large, Wolfgar turned that block into a sudden punch, sending the hammer's head out to connect heavily with the shoulder of his opponent. The man staggered back several steps, grimacing, his torn shoulder curled before him. Wolfgar waited until he started to straighten, then hurled Aegis Fang into his chest, throwing him away. "Tempus!" Wolfgar roared in victory, thinking the fight at an end. But even as the hammer reappeared in his waiting hand, Brevenden Margaster pulled himself up from the deck, glaring hatefully at Wolfgar, standing as if he was hardly injured. And there, before Wolfgar's eyes, the man began to change. He began to shrink in on himself, going from the muscled body of a human to a lithe and more elf-like form. His face grew very red. At first, Wolfgar thought it was the blood of rage, but no, his skin itself became a reddish-brown hue. He pulled off his now ill-fitting breastplate and tossed it aside, and finally, most tellingly, a pair of leathery wings sprouted from behind his shoulders, rising wide and ominously. His crew cheered. They had known. The crew of Joanne's heirloom, the few on this ship at least, recoiled in horror. Wolfgar glanced to the side, thinking to retreat. He saw, though, that there was nowhere to run, for this demon's minions were winning on Joanne's heirloom and seemed as much in control of that ship now as this one. So Wolfgar took up Aegis Fang, thinking to at least kill this demon creature. "I am with you," came a voice in his head. "Fight without fear. Strike when it is time and fear not your opponent's blade." Wolfgar wasn't sure what that meant, but he had witnessed enough of the strange powers of Camurriel O'Blodra to know that the drow had put something devious in motion. The barbarian leaped ahead, roaring to his god, closing on the demon with a series of short and powerful chops of his warhammer. He drove the creature back on its heels and might have bowled it right over and buried it then and there, but those wings thrashed at the air and kept the demon aloft, even lifted it from the deck at one point so that its block of Wolfgar's strike sent it farther backward than the barbarian had intended, causing him to overbalance forward. He tried to retreat, but too late, and that awful flaming blade got in over Aegis Fang's block and drove hard into his forearm. And did nothing, startling both Wolfgar and the demon. No, not nothing, Wolfgar realized, for he felt the energy of that strike thrumming within him, and so solved the riddle. For this was a trick Camurriel had used before, and very recently with Drizzt and Menzo Berenzon, creating a telekinetic barrier that absorbed the power of every strike, magical or physical, holding it in stasis, ready for the magically armored person to release it back. Grinning fiercely, Wolfgar charged in ferociously, not even trying to defend, accepting the demon's strikes in order to get in some of his own. He didn't release the mounting energy, not yet, wanting to utterly destroy the being when he turned its own strikes back on it. That would come sooner than he had expected, he realized, when a crossbow quarrel slammed him in the back, but did not penetrate. The demon's crew was charging him, striking with clubs and gaffs, swords and spears. Wolfgar swatted them aside with Aegis Fang, trying to keep his focus on the demon, but it got around him with a flying leap, landing back amidships near the mainmast. Wolfgar turned and charged, desperately so, for he understood that he could not hold this energy within him much longer. Perhaps not at all, for he could feel his blood beginning to churn, and he understood instinctively that if he didn't throw forth the kinetic power, it would implode within him, obliterating him wholly. So he charged at the demon, ignoring the others, and leaped headlong, launching a powerful swipe. But the demon dodged. Aegis Fang struck the mainmast, and Wolfgar had no choice but to release the gathered energy. The explosion rocked both ships, the warhammer exploding through the thick oaken beam with ease, separating it so cleanly from the trunk that it fell straight down upon the deck like a giant spear, blasting through, tearing lines on both ships, crashing down to the hull shell and more. No one on that deck, not even Wolfgar, was still standing against the shock of that blast, but the demon, up in the air, had escaped its effects. The mast leaned to the right, away from Joanne's heirloom. creaking and groaning. Rigging lines snapped, a spar fell free, and the mast went over more, tilting the ship to port. Men and women slid down the sloping deck, some grabbing at the rail, but that too was soon swamped. Wulfgar caught the base of the mast and there held until the demon swooped down and drove its sword across his back. He wasn't protected by Kimuriel's telekinetic barrier any longer, and felt his skin tearing, felt the fiery bite of the jagged blade, felt the lethal demonic poison. He was sliding, but hardly knew it. Then he was in the water. Somewhere he sensed the profound chill, though consciously, he hardly registered it.